Appetizers and desserts, and they have beautiful vegan and gluten-free offerings, as well as craft beer and eclectic wines. Farm Star Pizza is open 7 days a week for lunch and dinner, with live music every Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday evening. They're located in Chico at 2359 The Esplanade. You can also find Farm Star Pizza on Facebook and at farmstarpizza.com. And we're also made possible by Peter Tichinen, now a real estate broker associate with Century 21 Jeffries Lydon, urging you to support community radio. Peter can be reached by calling 530-680-1900 or at chicohomes.com. This is KCFR 90.1 FM in Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Up next, Non-Human Radio. Welcome to the September 12th, 2018 episode of Non-Human Radio, where we talk animal rights and veganism every Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. here on KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico and streaming online at kzfr.org. With me, as usual, is my co-host, Danny Toms. Please, Danny, give the listeners a summary of what they'll be hearing in the next half hour.
Today, we'll be talking about new research showing the link between farm antibiotics and human illness. Then we'll talk about how Hurricane Florence is threatening North Carolina's pig farm manure lagoons. Spoiler, it's crappy. And we'll end with the story of a horse, a victim of neglect, who is taking his former owner to court, which actually Mr. Ed probably should have done. Take it away, Jeannie.
Mr. Ed would have had an easier time of it than this horse.
All eight of the Mr. Eds that all died in a row or whatever.
All right. Thanks, Danny. Our first story is by Marion McKenna from the Wired website from September 7th, and it is about antibiotic resistance. For almost seven decades, we've routinely fed antibiotics to the animals we eat. That's just a few years less than we humans have been taking antibiotics ourselves. And for just about as long, it's been clear that those antibiotic doses have been creating drug-resistant bacteria that pass from meat animals to make humans sick when we eat them. The first outbreaks of drug-resistant foodborne illness were spotted as early as the mid-1950s when an epidemic of resistant salmonella swept through southeastern England. That was the first of many outbreaks, some small and some very large and widespread. One of the largest foodborne illnesses in U.S. history was tracked back to chickens that had been given antibiotics in their feed, and that was an outbreak that made 634 people in 29 states and Puerto Rico sick, and that was back in 2013. The connection between animal feed, antibiotics, and human illness is not universally accepted, although it's been in the public health sphere for decades now. Most of the studies linking farm antibiotic use and human illness have been observational, not experimental, which has given animal agriculture and the pharmaceutical industries room to insist that the case against farm antibiotic overuse is not solid. The argument has been that the bacterial traffic from animals to meat back to humans isn't proven. And until it can be established with 100% certainty, the practice of giving livestock preventative antibiotics should continue. And this author called it preventative antibiotics, and really antibiotics are fed to farm animals to help them gain weight. It's not to keep them healthy. It's not to keep them necessarily curing an illness. It is to help them put on weight so that they are more profitable.
Does it physically cause that, or does it reduce just so many of the random diseases and diarrheas and things they get?
It probably counteracts just what is probably a terrible environment that they are in.
Yeah, they're certainly not. They don't treat sick cows. They're animals. They kill them.
Exactly. Yeah, so they're culled. Yeah, they don't even treat healthy young animals. They kill them too. You know. So, A new study that has been years in the making goes further than any other to demonstrate that resistant bacteria can and do move from animals to humans via the meat the animals become. It's just one study, but it has outsized significance because it eliminates the uncertainty at the center of that bacterial flow. Outside of experimental conditions, it's never been possible to prove that a specific antibiotic given to a specific animal gave rise to this to a particular bacterium that ends up in a human, right? But this new work looks really deeply into the genomics of bacterial adaptation in food animals and in humans, and it proves the link that conventional farmers are hard at work denying. So every 2 weeks for a year, the researchers bought meat in a Flagstaff supermarket, and at the same time, they collected bacteria from the blood and urine of patients who were in a hospital in Flagstaff at the same time. And they analyzed both sets of samples for the presence of resistant bacteria. And the idea was to capture the bacteria's prevalence and create a timeline of when strains arrived and how they spread across the city. So when they arrived in the food supply and when they started spreading in the human population. If possible, they hope to prove that the strain's origin and also in the direction of how the bacteria spread. The microbial target that the research chose to focus on was not the most common foodborne bacteria that we all heard of or have heard of, like Salmonella, Campylobacter, and Shigella. It's already clear that those have a self-evident connection to food and farming, but not necessarily related to antibiotics. It could just be associated with general filth and, unsanitary conditions. Some researchers have become concerned about another foodborne bacterial threat that has a significant public health impact, and that is a specific subset of E. coli, good old E. coli that is all critters have. But this type of coli, E. coli, is called EXPEC, E-X-P-E-C, and that stands for extra intestinal pathogenic E. coli. This was a new term for me. It describes dangerous forms of E. coli that can escape the gut and cause infections in other parts of the body. So they are no longer confined to our intestinal tract. They leave the intestinal tract and they set up housekeeping and do damage in other parts of the body. Urinary tract infections are often one of the first signs of EXPEC infections. Untreated UTIs can climb up the urinary tract to the kidneys and pass from there into the bloodstream. And these drug-resistant UTIs are effectively untreated because they don't respond to the antibiotics that are usually given to treat urinary tract infections, right? So you present with a urinary tract infection and they give you a standard full-spectrum antibiotic. These E. coli, these EXPEC E. coli, are not, they're like, go for it. Yeah. We'll carry on. This is not affecting us. These particular EXPECs, these E. coli, this form of E. coli, also can cause more serious illness than the usual foodborne infections and can escalate to septic shock and death, right, because they're just rampant in your body. So the team took meat samples from the Flagstaff supermarkets, and they took the bacterial isolates from the cultures from blood and urine from Flagstaff hospital patients back to the lab and looked for organisms that were shared in both samples. And they found that E. coli, which is ubiquitous, in almost 82% of the meat samples and 72% of the samples from the patients, right? So in most of the meat samples, there's E. coli, and in most of the patients, there's E. coli, as you can imagine, because we have E. coli. Among the many E. coli strains they found was one known as H22, which was present both on chicken meat and in people. And additionally, when they looked at the DNA of these bacteria, that showed that these E. coli had occupied the guts of poultry first and then showed other markers that they had adapted in the guts of humans. So this is what earlier studies of EXPECs on meat and in humans lacked. This is evidence that shows that meat strains and human infections were linked because it's the same particular variety of E. coli. And it links them not just in time and location, but also in movement from animal to person. Researchers also found that E. coli strains that cross from birds to people were more likely than any other strains in the samples to be resistant to the antibiotics tetracycline and gentamicin, which are used in poultry production.
Uh-huh.
That affirms the observation made in hundreds of studies at this point, an observation, but not proof, that antibiotic use on farms creates resistant bacteria that crosses to humans. Earlier studies lacked evidence that meat strains and human infections were linked not just in time and location, but in movement from animal to person, and this shows that. And it should scare the heck out of you, all right?
I'm not going to eat chicken anymore.
And I just think, you know, this is not something that the animal meat industry wants to recognize. There's actually, the article went into more detail, there's inspection protocols that the FDA has and USDA has to monitor slaughterhouses, but they don't actually check for these bacteria. Hmm. They don't do a very good job. They'll start testing once after the animal's slaughtered and once it enters the slaughterhouse, but it won't trace back very carefully to the original source, which is just a big problem for us.
There's also such a massive volume of poultry being slaughtered.
And so quickly. Yeah.
And I imagine they're probably, I don't know, you might know, I would imagine poultry probably gets sick more than, you know, larger animals because they're more tightly confined, whereas cows are at least sometimes out on the range for a while.
Oh, yeah, I would presume, yeah, but I don't know. I am not an animal science expert. So, yeah, so I just thought that was an interesting study. I think that, you know, we're not looking at the usual pathogens. I mean, clearly we've all heard about E. coli outbreaks that come from the, you know, the not fully cooked tri-tip steak or the hamburger issues. But this kind of makes it more clear that these types of infections can escape our usual toolbox.
Yeah.
And these types of infections are already antibiotic resistant because of what we feed our farm animals.
And there's no treatment. If you get this, you probably will get very sick and or die.
Yeah, you need supportive treatment.
And as this escalates, you know, this is the vanguard, just like the MRSA in hospitals, the resistant bacteria.
Oh, the
there.
Staph, yeah.
Yeah, the staph, you know, we're starting to see hints of resistant drugs after this 60 odd so years. There's some controls, but it's going to get worse. And there's not, and once it hits, it's going to, you know, like when a flu comes, when something sweeps over, it's a plague. It's terrible. And if there is no solution, it's even worse, especially if it's a situation of our own creating here. So you think about like evolution and the generations, you know, to develop resistance to do this stuff. So we're doing this so fast, so many chickens, so many animals, so much antibiotics.
For sure.
Yeah, these things are evolving at a much heightened scale to pick up this resistance faster probably than we would be able to figure out some kind of solution.
So if you want the links to that story, they are posted with the show notes on the Non-Human Radio Facebook page, and it's interesting reading. There's also a link to the original, the recently released peer-reviewed science article, journal article that this layman's version of the story is based on. You've been listening to Animal News on Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM, listener-supported community radio. Over to you, Danny.
Our next news piece is an article from QZ.com speculating on what will happen when Hurricane Florence makes landfill this week and hits North Carolina's massive pig manure lagoons. North Carolina is one of the biggest hog farming states in the U.S., with about 9 million pigs being raised on some 2,300 farms. So even right there, 2,300 divided by 9 million is a lot of pigs everywhere. So that equals a lot of manure. About 10 billion pounds of wet animal waste are produced in the state a year, according to the nonprofit environmental group Waterkeeper Alliance. Well, surely there must be a safe method for disposing of all this manure. That's 10 billion pounds a year, right? It was probably treated as responsibly as, say, nuclear waste.
It's safe and efficient and as cheap as possible.
So how do they store all this toxic stuff? Farms store the pig's waste in uncovered earthen lagoons, some the size of football fields. A lagoon is a giant open-air pit or swimming pool. Don't swim in these pools, by the way.
You know what it's like? So when you're driving on Highway 99, you're going towards Gridley in Sacramento.
Yeah.
On the east side of Highway 99, there are some old catfish ponds. There was once a business that tried to make a go of it. And those are earthen ponds that they once tried to raise catfish in. And you can actually see now some of those sides of those ponds have been were taken away so that they no longer hold water.
Ah, I see.
It's like that, but a little bigger too.
Or giant rice paddy. So let's see. These lagoons now are at risk of becoming a public health hazard when Hurricane Florence slams into them. The storm is set to sweep through North Carolina on Thursday or Friday, and the manure lagoons are right in its path. A farming journal urged hog farmers to prepare for the storm. And, of course, we've seen this before. In 2016, Hurricane Matthew inundated 14 hog manure lagoons. In the days leading up to the hurricane's landfall, some farmers pumped waste out of their lagoons and hauled it away in an effort to limit the damage. But again, that's the slightly more responsible farmers who have the time and the money to do that. Hurricane Floyd in 1999 did much worse, flooding dozens of hog farms and causing half a dozen lagoons to fail, which meant that their walls were breached. That liquid waste escaped and eventually wound up in estuaries and was blamed for algae blooms and fish kills. And there's probably a lot more hog farms now than in 1999, I would guess. Floodwaters that come in contact with hog feces make for a toxic soup, and it raises fears about the potential for bacteria from the pig feces to contaminate North Carolina's groundwater, hopefully with not any antibiotic-resistant bugs. Andy Curlis, the CEO of the North Carolina Pork Council, told Bloomberg that lagoons can handle as much as 25 inches of rain without failing. They planned ahead. According to AccuWeather forecasts, up to 40 inches of rain are expected in parts of North Carolina.
What could go wrong?
This is a place where hurricanes happen, and hurricanes don't just drop 25 inches of rain. As we've reported before, even without a massive storm on the way, daily life near a hog farm can be toxic. The world consumes cheap bacon at the expense of North Carolina's rural poor. Is it Duplin or Duplin County?
Duplin
County. The heart of North Carolina's hog country is one of the poorest in the state. It is disproportionately African-American and Hispanic compared to the rest of the state, and the smell of the excrement seeps into all aspects of routine life. Research on health impacts of hog farms is lacking, but studies point to effects ranging from impaired memory function to higher infant mortality rates, higher asthma rates in children, higher blood pressure among the neighboring population.
Right, so similar to the antibiotic story, we don't have an experiment that's going on. It's all observational, so we don't really need to take action on it.
Yeah, you know, anyone who's driven through either Stockton or farther down I-5, what is it, Harris Ranch?
Yeah.
You know, for the 2 minutes you drive by and go, oh God, what does that smell? You know, that's basically large parts of Duplin County, the entire county. It's not 2 minutes. It's poor people have to live in that. And I suspect the farmers might even live somewhere else or, you know, high up on a hill. This part of the animal agriculture story is one of poverty and racial inequality and how those forces play out in a state where the hog industry has emerged as both essential to the economy, but also an oppressor of the poorer communities of color, which brings up questions about the quality of life in the world's richest nation, which will tolerate that these things for its poorer citizens. Questions that have been thrown into sharp relief by the recent entry into North Carolina of China's, indeed the world's largest pork processor, WH Group. Drawn by the low cost of production there, WH Group finds it cheaper to raise pigs in North Carolina and export them to tables back home than to raise the animals in China. And this irony is not lost on the poorer residents of Duplin County. So, in the current state of things, this is all terrible, and it's terrible indeed that it's cheaper for China to come here and use our systems of exploitation to grow and exploit these animals and the people, because it's actually cheaper than doing it back home, which is pretty darn cheap in China. And not that it should be, but it is. Keep that in mind. You know, I remember as a kid, bacon was expensive, you know, and now bacon wraps everything and everybody chants bacon, bacon, bacon. And, you know, that comes at a cost to animals and to people.
Yeah, sure. In 2016, they estimated more than 5 million farmed animals died as a result of Hurricane Matthew, including millions of chickens and the thousands of pigs who we talked about here. And those animals I mean, it's tragic for people, but it's even more tragic for these animals who are locked in sheds and cages. And
yeah, they don't get an evacuation plan. Yeah.
No, actually, you know, and it's interesting. After Katrina, there are requirements for emergency responders to assist or plan for evacuation of companion animals. But farm animals are exempt from any kind of...
Yeah.
I guess they figure that it's in the farmer's interest to protect his investment.
It's not. I mean, it's not possible. You can't evacuate millions and millions of animals. Yeah. They shouldn't be concentrated and at those numbers like that to begin with.
Oh, and this was kind of fascinating. So all the chickens who died in Hurricane Mitchell, they were disposed of primarily through composting inside the houses where they were actually being raised. That's horrible. But what got me is that the North Carolina asked the U.S. Federal Emergency Management Agency for about $5 million to assist with the cost associated with composting those.
Yeah, agriculture is a great business if you believe in government
handouts.
You know, if my house burns down, the government is not going to help me. It's ridiculous.
All right. You've been listening to Animal News on Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM. Listener-supported community radio, co-hosted by Jeannie Trezino and Danny Toms. If you want to follow more current events and animal rights-related news, I invite you to follow the Non-Human Radio Facebook page, where I have a steady stream of items of interest. Our last story is about an abused horse suing his former owner for damages. Lawyers for Justice, who is an 8-year-old American Quarter horse, are suing his former owner. They're arguing that the horse, who is a victim of severe neglect, has standing in the case and has the right to sue as a plaintiff. In March 2017, Justice, who was formerly known as Shadow, was rescued from his home in Washington County, Oregon. He was 300 pounds underweight, covered in lice, and badly injured by frostbite. Sarah Hannigan, who is an attorney with the Animal Legal Defense Fund and one of the lawyers representing Justice, was quoted as saying, "As a result of neglect, Justice has sustained permanent injuries that will require extensive medical care for the remainder of his life. We feel that Justice has legally protected interests in Oregon." Advocates hope that the civil lawsuit to secure funding for his care will advance animal status under the law, but critics arguing giving animals the right to sue is a slippery slope. Justice's previous owner had filed a motion to have the civil case, which was filed in May of this year, dismissed, a move which the Animal Legal Defense Fund said was expected. The defendant argues that animals don't have standing, which is a common refrain you'll hear from detractors of efforts such as Justice's. The horse's owner pleaded guilty to criminal animal neglect in 2017 and was ordered to pay $3,000 in restitution, an amount Hannigan from Animal Legal Defense Fund said is very inadequate given the medical care Justice will need over time. Justice is currently living at the Oregon-based Sound Equine Options, which is a horse rescue and rehab organization co-founded by Kim Mosinen, who is now Justice's guardian. Justice's lawyers from the Animal Legal Defense say that the nonprofit horse sanctuary shouldn't have to fundraise to pay for Justice's care. The few protections that animals do have should be enforced by the state. But animals should have that right, like Justice, to go and enforce them themselves, too. That's pretty key there. Richard Epstein, on the devil's advocate side, who is an NYU law professor, finds the theory behind animal rights a dangerous one with broad implications. There's no question that this is a case of cruelty, he says, but it shouldn't give an animal who feels pain the same legal rights as humans. He says, if you create animals having rights, you then have to ask if the animals will now have the right to refuse being owned. And he goes on to say, this gets denounced as a form of speciesism, but if animals could talk to human beings and interchange any animal at any time, it would be fine. So basically he's saying, because we can't talk to the animals and they can't talk back in a way that we can understand, they are not deserving of rights, right? So Animal Legal Defense counters that the thought of that by saying, the fact that Justice is not able to speak to his lawyer is not a new concept in court. Often lawyers see human plaintiffs who can't speak for themselves or cannot consult their attorneys. She raises the example of young children or human beings who have been so badly injured that they're in a coma, and yet they have the right to sue. And they do sue through a guardian or other individual who represents their interests. So it's just going to be a matter of whether the courts in Oregon are ready to accept that animals have interests and that the laws are sufficient to protect them. I think this will be fascinating to watch. The laws in Oregon allow them a little wiggle room, allow Animal Legal Defense Fund a little wiggle room to try and make this thing fly.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, Oregon's a confusing mix of very liberal and very conservative, much like, say, Butte County.
Much like, yes.
So it might have a chance. At least it begins the discussion. And it is also, I think, a good point. So many people abuse animals or hoard animals or take in animals or adopt animals when they're about to leave the country or leave college or, you know, et cetera, and just think, okay, there's some nice rescue group that'll take care of them forever.
Yeah.
And it costs a ton of money.
And we're just kind of, this is just kind of push that envelope like the other, like the Non-Human Rights Project and their chimpanzee standing cases, where they're trying to kick animals out of the concept of being just mere property.
Yep.
So, looking forward to that.
All right, it's time for the animal... the Chico Animal Rights Calendar Events. I'd like to do an animal calendar events, but they don't tell me what they're doing. So
no, they have their own calendar, their own language, and they do their own thing.
Yep, and as they should. All right, Jeannie, what do you have on the official Chico Animal Rights Calendar Events?
All right, thank you. I thought I'd mention, before I dive into the calendar, as I usually do, that there are some great vegan eats that some of our listeners might like to check out. Have just popped up in the last week or so. The Winchester Goose continues to amaze and delight with its Wednesday vegan specials. Tonight they are serving what they described as the Raise Your Fungi Freak Flag, featuring bread from the Tin Roof Bakery with a house-made vegan cheese spread, Turkey Tail Farm oyster mushrooms, arugula tossed with a balsamic stout dressing, and toasted almonds with some balsamic reduction. And they do something... They do some kind of vegan concoction like that every Wednesday, and it's nice that they keep up that steady routine.
Yeah, it's tasty. It often sells out to whoever is there.
Yeah. So, and plus the Winchester Goose is one of the few really dog friendly places.
Yep.
They're like, bring your dog in. Here's a bowl of water. He's well behaved. Welcome to stay. Blackbird Books and Gallery just started selling vegan chocolate dipped salted caramel. Paletas, little frozen popsicles made from Bebert Almond Milk, our local almond milk company. And as I thought, we're getting towards the end of summer, and so you probably want to check these little delicious things out before it gets too cold and they're not desirable. And of course, Blackbird, which is on Park Avenue, continues to have an assortment of muffins, donuts, and cookies from Near and Dear Baked Goods, who is a great local vegan baker. And then I could have knocked me over with a vegan feather. Even Chico State is getting more vegan friendly. Someone posted a picture that the BMU, the school cafeteria, is now serving up the vegan Beyond Burger at its grill station. And I'm just like, where are the cattle ranchers? Why aren't they there protesting? And because they have...
Shh, Jeannie, now they're going to come.
Uh-oh, I spilled the beans. So anyway, I just thought that would be just some things of interest. It's funny how food news is also animal news.
Yeah.
On my radar,
right.
Because every time a restaurant is serving something that's not an animal, that's an animal that's saved.
Yeah, and there's a couple of new fancy restaurants in town that have very limited vegan options, like their menus from 1985 or something. And we'd encourage them to listen up.
All right. Let's go to the just a few animal rights calendar of event items. I'm just going to mention this because I think it's more of a nerdy thing that I like, but I think it's really cool. Tomorrow in Sacramento is the Art Mix CrockerCon at the Crocker Art Museum from 6 to 9:30 p.m. They are hosting a little mini cosplay comic convention with music, podcasters, some panel talks. It's for all ages. There's a little costume contest. It's really fun. Why am I mentioning this? Because they actually are promoting, they're going to be offering some delicious vegan eats. They have a vegan menu item, which is two street tacos with cabbage, onion, cilantro, and lime with a house-made chorizo and cashew cheese. So I'm just going to point that out there. If you've got some free time tomorrow afternoon, you can check out crockerart.org and get information on tickets. The Cooking for Compassion and Health Indian class has one seat open. You can get information on that at brownpapertickets.com. That is being taught by Cheryl Mercado from the Chico chapter of Dharma Voices for Animals. All right, I have run out of time. We are skipping to the end. We have one last piece of business to take care of, and that is the Animal Rights Quote of the Week. Take it away, Danny.
Today's Animal Rights Quote of the Week is from the book Animal Factories by Peter Singer.